Gorgeous day today here in the West County. Cannot believe it. Must have been about 70 degrees, I suppose. It was beautiful to all those listening in the far-flung reaches of the four corners of the earth. I hope your weather's a bit better than it has been in most other places. Yeah, if Louise in England, if the alarm clock got you up at three, hello. Thanks for listening in to my interview with Dave Glasson. He of the three bonzos and a piano, he is the piano, and a great British band, which descended from the Bonzo Dog Band from the 1960s and 70s, an incredible band, seminal band, you might say. And Dave also worked with Bob Kerr's Whoopee Band, and he did Tatiolity and the Slightly Dangerous Brothers. So, yeah, we should have a good time with his interview, and I'll be interspersing it with his music. And let's play some Dave Glasson. And this is back when he was with Bob Kerr's Whoopee Band. Whoopee. Ooh, that was the S&M version, I suppose. Bob Kerr's Whoopee Band. And this is a little ditty that Dave wrote and has writ called Victoria and Albert Museum.
Now, the next number written for us by David Glasson, our pianist. Keep clapping, keep clapping. Called the Victoria and Albert Museum. Over to you, Dave. Quite recently, one wet and windy day, I thought that I would step inside just to help you pass the time away. It wasn't long before I saw you looking at the Queen's portrait. He didn't know quite what to do. Go on, chatter up, mate, I said. Shut up. Yes? Wish I was as young as you.
Yes, I bet you do.
Walk along the corridors and have a look on all the floors. He didn't know quite what to say.
But we passed the time away, spinning the revolving doors. What a shame you've lost your hat. I never thought museums could be fun.
May I suggest you step outside? The sun is beginning to shine.
Tiki.
Victoria and Albert would blush to hear what you have in mind.
Oh, yes, yes, I bet they would.
We strolled around South Kensington. It must have been just after one. You said you must be getting back, otherwise you'd get the sack. I let you go reluctantly, but the way you looked at me told me that we had to meet again. Perhaps you might just step inside and find a treasure you can take away.
Okay, Dave Glasson in the Bob Kerr's Whoopee Band. And the Victorian Albert Museum, which is a real museum in London, if you don't know that, and a wonderful place, actually, to go to. But what a lovely ring to it. Almost as good a ring as Bossy and Bessie here in the Cow Studio in, yeah, deliquescent downtown Occidental. Go to my interview with Dave Glasson, a fine musician from England, and is now with the Three Bonzos and a piano, and has been with many bands, back comedic bands mainly, having a really good time, but some great big bands. So let's hear about Dave Glasson coming right up. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, no, it was really good to meet up with you a couple of months ago and see that part of the world, which I've always longed to go to.
But, you know, it sounds like you really enjoyed it, so...
Really did, yes, yeah. And you've obviously had a good look at the photos as well, so...
Yes,
a little bit of evidence there of our fun.
Indeed, where the bonzos do not fear to tread. You know.
Well, not anymore. Well, no, I mean, it came in the late 60s, 70s, didn't they, twice. But I think it didn't work out well enough for them.
Well, a number of the bonzos have said, you know, it wasn't a good time. I think just the way they were presented and Americans didn't get the humour, I
That's
think.
It. Although, funny enough, you know, our CDs available on a website. It's also available on CD Baby, which I know is an American-based thing in Oregon.
Right.
And more and more Americans are ordering the CD. I know, because I have to deal with the ones on the website, and then CD Baby are always asking me for a top-up of CDs. So it's really good that, you know, the U.S. citizens are remembering and or maybe the new ones, I don't know, new customers to us seem to be getting into it more and more. So it's quite exciting, really.
I think it is. Well, I think all music is equal now, whether it was done 50 years ago, 10 years ago or today. I think the kids don't particularly care.
No, I think you're right. It's sort of merged. And, of course, parents pass on their interests to kids. And sometimes the kids listen. Of course, sometimes they don't. But that's an influence in itself. If they're growing up hearing bonzo music around the house,
I wonder how twisted you become from a young age. You know,
yeah. It probably explains a lot about the youth of the day.
Exactly. But you know, it's the bonzos and really came from. From the old days, I mean, Spike Jones, I mean, all those influences, they pulled together, English vaudeville, music hall, that was the interesting thing about, I think, the bonzos.
They did, they dealt backwards, didn't they, really, to start with, anyway, in stuff they were very interested in, going around markets, picking up 78s and things, and learning those songs, like My Brother Makes the Noises, and Bring a Watermelon, and all that sort of thing.
Right.
So, and that brought those songs to a whole new generation.
Yes.
Who probably thought, well, the bonzos have written those because they put their own unique twist on it. Of course, it's a while later you realise that those are songs written by other people quite a while before, 30s. That sort of thing. And then gradually, of course, we all know, they started to write some great stuff. I mean, I was not really aware of the bonzos prior to Gorilla.
Mm.
And I was introduced to Gorilla. Funny enough, I just left music college. I'd trained, classically, although I'd always had an interest in sort of pop of the day and trying to work out the songs of the Beatles and the Stones on the piano.
Mm-hmm.
When I left college, I was looking for a job that involved music, ideally playing the piano, and foolishly I went to the job centre, whatever the equivalent of it was in those days.
Oh my goodness.
Sorry?
I'm just like, oh my goodness, what a great idea.
Yeah. So what can I do? Have you got any jobs for piano players, So they said, well, we're not really handle those sort of things. Your best thing is to look in the music trade papers. And in that day, the Melody Maker was the one where, everybody advertised for musicians under the headings of bass or guitar or piano. There wasn't keyboard even then. The electric keyboard hadn't come out. Synths were just scratching the surface. Maybe organ, obviously, but I looked under piano, and there was a few adverts, and the one that looked, well, I'll try that one, was asking for a pianist in the Waller Morton style.
The Waller Morton? Oh, Fats Waller.
Waller Morton style. Well, I'd never heard of Waller Morton. Don't forget, I've been trained through Chopin and Beethoven and Bach and all that sort of stuff. And if it wasn't that, it was pop music. And I hadn't really, my parents hadn't really got into jazz in any way, so I'd never really heard much jazz.
Mm.
So I'd never heard of Waller Morton, who I thought was the first and second name of a person.
Right.
But anyway, I thought, well, I'll go along and I'll just tell him whoever he is, I'll have a go. And I got to the agency and there was no piano there. That was a bit of relief. But it turned out I was the only one who turned up. So I got the job without hearing me. And that was for a band called Spencer's Washboard Kings.
Oh.
That was in, 67, late 67.
Hmm.
And the next thing was, the next week, they were going off on tour. That's why they were panicking. I think their piano player had just left them. Because they were going on tour for a month to Scandinavia. And I explained, I said, well, I've never played in a jazz style before. And it wasn't as if they could give me any records. I didn't own a record player or anything like that to listen to. So, but they did suggest you can go to this guy who is an exponent of the jazz piano style. Of this era, because I don't know if you know Spencer's Washboard Kings, but they do very tight arrangements, among which include people like Fletcher Henderson and those sort of things.
Oh, okay.
Wonderful stuff. It turned out, but to me, I was terrified, of course, at first. But they sent me to this guy called Neville Dickey, who was really a ragtime piano player.
Hmm.
And I went to his house, and he was a very nice guy, and showed me the ropes. And the band had sent me the chord book, which literally was page by page a title of a song and a set of chords, no melody.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't know the title of the song. I'd never heard of many of these songs at all before, really. Well, most of them. So you see, like a title like Nobody's Sweetheart Now, and a page of chords. You didn't know how fast it went, how long each chord lasted. Because was totally foreign music to me. I've been used to reading sort of two staves, sometimes three staves if it was Liszt, and with a church organ. So it was quite an eye opener. And he explained how to read it. And then he said, I said, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm working out these Scott Joplin rags. And he sat down and played, and he said, this is the one I'm currently working on. He was working through it really very slowly, so I thought he's being ultra careful, ultra accurate, but in fact, that's as fast as he could read it.
Oh.
And the one thing that I must thank my very first piano teacher for when I was tiny was that she gave me a fresh piece of music every week, so I just became such a great sight reader. It never ever was a stumbling block for me, reading.
Oh,
improvisation and styles, they were, it had to be done by ear, because that's the trouble, your eye develops reading, but other parts in my case, certainly, the improvisation part never really did take off in a jazz way.
Oh, interesting.
I wasn't exposed to it, I suppose. That was the thing. And of course, you don't know that you don't know these things until much later on in life.
When
you try and do something about it, sometimes successful, sometimes not quite. I suddenly realised that the rest of the guys in Spencer's Washboard Kings, none of them had any music in front of them. That was amazing. I'd only played with people who read music. And they just seemed to know the keys, the songs, the tempos, the chords, the melody. They just seemed to know. And of course, as I'm now, like, sort of 40, 50 years down the line, I know nearly everybody in this line of work does that.
Punctuation is all you need. write to me. There's words all over the page, but when I write to you, I'll get in such a rage. Don't know what to say, how I really feel. Just a load of dots and dashes, what I need is spill. Can't read,
can't read,
can't write,
can't write,
can't spell.
What the hell?
Punctuation, punctuation, punctuation is all you need.
All summer must agree, double exclamation mark, colon, semicolon, asterisk, and question mark, inverted commas, dash, open brackets, silence brackets, adding up a list, nothing to write home about.
Each time I write to you, I'll get in such distress. Cause you're always telling me my letters are a mess. And though what I have written may not be that neat, one thing is for certain, it's bloody well complete. Can't read,
can't read,
can't write,
can't write,
can't spell.
What the hell?
Punctuation, punctuation, punctuation. Here we go.
All stop apostrophe, double exclamation mark, colon, semicolon, asterisk and question mark, inverted commas, dash, open brackets, close brackets, and enough of this, nothing to write over that. Full stop.
You heard Punctuation by Three Bonzos and a Piano, which has my guest on tonight, Dave Glasson. So why don't we get back to my interview with Dave?
You know, you said you started piano at a very young age. How young was it, and what decided the piano for you?
Well, as in most kids' cases, I suppose, parents. I think my dad was a frustrated, untrained musician. He had a great ear and an innate ability to, you know, for music, to play piano, play drums, whatever it was. He had a really excellent mind for it. And I think he was a, you know, frustrated musician, really, without ever having had the opportunity to train. So I guess he thought, well, we'll see how David can do. And they got a piano in, and I do remember about half a dozen, if not more, of the notes didn't press down at the time. all around the middle, all the ones that you'd use most commonly.
Oh, no.
They did get that fixed fairly quickly. Fixed me up with lessons with by the way, listeners, is in Accrington in Lancashire, where I started my early part of my life. A wonderful piano teacher called Mrs. Sargent was great with young kids. Remember, I was eight. So, eight is about a good age. And she was terrifically encouraging. You know, she used to give you a piece, and you'd learn to read music from day one. And if you did okay, she'd give you a gold, a coloured star. If you did pretty good, she'd give you a silver star. And then when you cracked it, she'd give you a gold star. And you stick these on the page of the music, you know, and you work through the music. So very encouraging and a great idea. And she was, you know, whether or not I did crack it, I would never really know on each piece. But she knew not to dwell for every finite detail with a young kid, and would get me onto the next piece. Until in the end, you know, she got me up to Debussy stuff and things like that. And that was really, you know, I've got to thank her for that sight reading, those sight reading skills that she gave me. Not that I realised that's what she was doing, because, of course, at that stage, you'd think this is what it is.
Right.
So she trained me in that, and then my second piano teacher, because my parents then moved to Livingston Ends, which is near Blackpool on the west coast of Lancashire. I moved to another piano teacher called Miss Jones, who was quite the opposite, very strict. In fact, you know, had the reputation to rap knuckles, and I think I had my knuckles wrapped more than once. But she trained myself and other students to play piano duets, for instance. I've never done that before, so that was an interesting exercise. And also she put us in for music competitions.
Oh.
So you got used to hearing other kids playing the same tunes as you, or other kids just playing anything, which you wouldn't normally do, especially with a piano, because it's a sort of solo instrument. It's not like you would join an orchestra and you'd be one of 30 violins.
Right.
So that was good, and trained you to go on stage and perform, as it were. But she was fierce, scary lady. But gradually, I went to a grammar school near there called Kirkham Grammar School.
Oh, yeah.
And the music teacher there lived in Lytton St. Anne's, and eventually I switched to him for piano lessons, because he also taught me church organ.
Mm.
And went right through to A-level with Jim Murray. And he was great, because he was one who was into exam grades and things, more of a needs to an end, really, because he was preparing me for music college, which was about the only thing I was good at. And so he said, you will need a grade exam to show to the people when they interview and audition you. And also, the interesting thing is, when we applied as piano's first study, this is to Trinity College of Music in London, the second study instrument was going to be the organ. And of course, this is church organ, you know, full size pedal board, two or three manuals or more. They said you can't do two keyboard instruments. So I had to suddenly think, what could I could do as a second instrument, because I only played piano and organ.
Yeah.
And Jim suggested clarinet. You know, you said if it was any other. And that was really because of the influence of people like Acker Bilt, who we're seeing on the telly, which is exactly Roger's story, isn't it? Because I seem to remember Roger saying that he was influenced to pick up the clarinet as his first instrument from hearing Acker Bilt, Roger Ruskin Spear, that is, one of our three bonzos.
That's right.
I took the clarinet up in a sixth form, but I never really got on with it, you know. And at college, they had three orchestras. Obviously, the first and second were for the main orchestral instrument, first study players. Mm. Third and fourth orchestra were for the second study players. I didn't even get into the fourth orchestra. I had a lot of trouble with mouth ulcers and things, and excuse me, I could rarely play from one lesson to the next because the ulcers were giving me jip.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so, and it's sad, really, because my parents, you know, obviously have to shell out for these instruments at that stage in your life. And in fact, the clarinet teacher I had recommended to go to music college, you needed a pair of clarinets. And clarinet players will know what I mean by that. The traditional one is a B-flat clarinet, and also there's an A clarinet, semitone, lower, so that you can play in different keys. When whatever orchestral music you're playing, make life easier for you. So I went along with my pair of clarinets, never got the A1 out of the case ever, I don't think.
Oh, no.
Played that one for lessons, and that was about it. And as soon as I left college, I sold them and bought my first car. So that's the story of my clarinet playing. I can still play Stranger on the Shore.
Oh, okay.
If somebody handed me a clarinet with a decent reed.
Yeah.
But happily, the story doesn't end there, because my daughter Charlotte plays, among other things, the clarinet, although that's one not one top of her list of instruments she plays. She's a sax player and violinist, funny enough.
Oh. Again,
yeah.
Two very different instruments.
Yes, yeah, very versatile. Well, I think maybe subconsciously, I don't know, we started her off on the violin when she was very young, age 5.
Mm.
And then she wanted to play saxophone when she was about 13. And then she went to music college and did those two instruments as first and second studies, and then swapped them around after the first year.
Oh, okay.
In my day, you know, maybe it was just me, but you don't sort of challenge any decisions that were made for you. You know, you agreed to do the clarinet second study, and even though it was a hopeless case from the word go, you know, somebody should have said, well, you know, change the rules, let him do the organ or something, you know, because I missed out there on 3 years of organ training, which I would have probably blossomed at.
The organ, did you ever go do any church organ work at all?
Funny you should ask me that, because Just this last week, well, this week, in fact, Monday this week, my wife went to see our children, Charlotte, we've mentioned, and Sam is our son who plays drums, play in a pub in Lewis with a keyboard player who I've always known as a piano player, a guy called Terry Seabrook. He's he runs a very good sort of Latin setup and has been doing for many years and teaches as well, highly respected musician and piano player, and I like to hear him. So we went along to watch, and he's not playing the piano, he's playing the organ. He got an organ out. So I thought, oh, this is going to be interesting. And it was for the rest of the evening. So I had a chat with him afterwards, and he said, "You ever play organ?" I said, "Well, I used to do church organ many years ago." And he was suddenly very interested. He said, "Well, that was with sort of full pedal board then, was it?" "I don't do pedals," he said. I said, "Well, yeah, we had to do the toe heel stuff and all of it." He said, "Can you still do it, and all the manuals and the stops and things?" I said, "Well, every organ does, as organists will know, every organ is different. You do need to sort of familiarize yourself with an organ if you go along to these different churches, which is mostly where they are."
Right.
And in the last 3 years, two of our friends' daughters have got married, one daughter and one son in another family, and have asked me to play the organ for their weddings. So, full music service with hymns and music to come in, music to go out, and the stuff in between. So, at two different churches, which I've had to go along a couple of months before, once a week, and get the vicar's permission to practice the organ when all is quiet, and just familiarise myself as well. And I really enjoyed it, actually. You know, it was nice to be asked to do that. So, got my hand back in on doing the church organ.
Oh, excellent.
Whether anybody's listening who's thinking, "Oh, we'll get him to come along every Sunday and play," or I don't really think I've got the commitment for every Sunday.
you can repeat. They don't know where they stick their feet. They walk in this, that, and the other. They tread in your dinner and bring you bother. They spread germs all over the place. Nasty diseases, a real disgrace. There's no hope, you cannot train them. Just one answer, you have to brain them. Biff, bang, on his head. Knock the nasty critter dead. Split, splat, knock them flat. Then you know that that is that.
Ones buzz and drive you crazy. Little ones swarm and make the air hazy. There's too many for just one man. So here's the answer in his handy can.
Squirt, spray, give them hell. This'll really make them ill. They don't like it, just too bad. You have to whack them.
It's hard to believe, as you'll agree, flies have a place in the ecology. Without those flies, we'd all be stuck, up to our necks in unpleasant muck.
Nature's way can be quite odd. Have to blame it all on God. Why he made them, I can't fathom. So come on, boys.
Come on, boys. This'll really make them ill. They don't like it, just too bad. You have to whack them. Split, bang, on his head. Knock the nasty critter dead. Split, splat, knock him flat. Then you know that that is that. Split, splat, knock him flat. Squirt, spray, take that and that. Biff, bang, soon be over. Look out, folks, here comes another. Yee-haw!
Ooh. Yeah. Gotcha. Missed.
Ooh, thank goodness he got that one. Yeah, Flies, and that's by the Three Bonzos and a Piano, which features my interview guest this week, Dave Glasson. And before that, keeping in the fly motif, I'm a Fly, and that was on Roger Ruskin Spears' amazing Electric Shocks album from 72. Let's go back to my interview with Dave.
Talked about Charlotte, your daughter. Now, she's not just any musician. She is a very accomplished musician in her own right.
Absolutely. You have a look at charlotteglasson.com when you get a chance. She's incredibly busy and very prolific. Driven, she is. Writes stuff all the time. She's got 3 or 4 CDs out, all available on her website. And writes a lot of original stuff. Will play anything in any style. Very versatile, brilliant reader, a wonderful improviser, invited to play with various people. The first one, I think, was one of the first big ones, was Oasis. Mm. She did a track on Oasis, standing on the shoulder of giants, playing the flute, another of her instruments. And then there's a band here called Divine Comedy, which is really, in nowadays, just the lead guy, Neil Hannon, who just writes to some wonderful stuff. And sometimes he plays with full orchestra. Sometimes it's just a 5 or 6 piece. And whichever one it is, he uses Charlotte because she can play, as I say, sax, violin, flute, clarinet, in his band or his orchestra, whatever that might be. She's played with Claire Martin quite a lot, the jazz singer. Oh, I know. The obvious one, why did I come to LA 2 months ago?
Oh.
Well, she's playing, she played with an orchestra called the Lost and Found Orchestra in a show called Pandemonium. And they are the guys who put that show together, who put Stomp together.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Also from Brighton, funny enough, where I am now from. She'd played in this Lost and Found Orchestra since its inception in 2006. Started off at the Brighton Festival, then it went to Sydney Festival, played in the Sydney Opera House, Amsterdam, Royal Festival Hall, and we'd gone to all of these things. We'd sort of become international groupies following us around. So the fact when she was coming to play in the US, we couldn't miss the opportunity. So we waited for a good time for gigs, and came out to LA, as you know. And of course, our son Sam was in it. He wasn't in that American one because he wasn't able to be there. And also reduce the numbers involved. But he's been involved in that one as well. So, you know, we're fairly used to seeing them in all sorts of venues and types of music, both of them, really. And, yes, we sit there quietly proud, my wife and I. of course, we advise both of them that music was not a career worth following. No, no money at all, but they're doing okay.
Well, let's go back a bit, and we last left you at Spencer's Washboard Kings.
Yes.
What went from there?
That lasted 6 months, and just going back to Waller Morton, listeners, I did realise very soon afterwards that was two people, actually. That's Waller and Jelly Roll. And I then went out of my way to find some recordings so I could listen to them. I've loved Fats Waller particularly ever since. Just a wonderful stride style that he plays. Never be able to get anywhere near it, but I make an attempt now and then. So that band lasted, well, the band lasted for a long time, but the players seemed to change around my time about every 6 months. And about 6 months after I joined, there was a drummer in Spencer's called Bill Short, who had brought with him on the Scandinavian tour this album called Gorilla, which I knew nothing about. And as I reflect on it now, I think, what an odd thing to do. The band's going on tour, and you take a vinyl LP with you to play. You know, these days, it's iPods, isn't it, in your breast pocket, and no size at all. But this guy didn't take a record player, but there must have been hopeful. Well, obviously he did find one, because this is where I first heard it, in Denmark. And I just thought it was great. I thought it was so... so many words spring to mind, not one I can think of at the moment. Anarchic, really. You know, something like taking the mick out of the Tony Bennett song, I Left My Heart in San Francisco. I'll mention that one.
Oh, good.
just creased me up that, you know, they were getting away with that on a record. Wow.
Yeah.
Very daring. So I've been a fan ever since. When Spencer's fizzled out, it fizzled out because Bill, who I'd mentioned, Bill Short, knew a guy called Bob Kerr. And he knew Bob Kerr had been in the Bonzos, had left to join the new Vaudeville band, which had the hit with Winchester Cathedral. And then Bob had left that to do something of his own, and he wanted he had good connections to Bob. He always has and still has, I'm sure. And he knew somebody in the BBC who was putting together a TV program of American presidents, and they wanted a band each of the 10 weeks of the series to play the presidential campaign songs. And all he had was a cassette tape that had been sent over. Or maybe even reel-to-reel in those days. Don't know. But it was a tape, certainly.
Yeah.
Talking to Bill Short, I guess, he said, well, there's this guy, Dave, in our band who reads music. He might be able to sort of transcribe it for the tape. So that's when I met Bob, and I agreed to do that. And I then became the piano player with that group of musicians, which for the sake of the program, he called the Whoopee Band,
okay.
And the name stuck, although quite a few of the musicians changed, because Bob decided he wanted to go down a more visual line. He was a huge fan of Spike Jones. So it went down the visual cabaret fun side, very much as he'd experienced, obviously, in the Bonzos. And I'd never seen anything on TV, as you wouldn't in those days, or been to a live show of the Bonzos or anybody else. Spencer's Washboard Kings used to do a half hour, what they call their comedy cabaret set, and sometimes, going back to Spencer, sorry to keep going backwards, they'd look at the audience through the curtains and say, oh, we won't do the comedy tonight. They were able just to play, you know, straight jazz as well, very, very good hot straight jazz. So that was interesting. They could switch the comedy on and off.
Yeah, really?
But Whoopee Band was a comedy band, and very good musicians in that band as well. And so Bob formed that officially in 68, about then. And the band expanded slightly about a few months later when a guy called Sam Spoons joined. He'd recently left the Bonzo Dog Band, and he brought along another guy called Biff Harrison. They were being a little duo, and they merged into the Whoopee Band. And shortly after that, a guy from the Temperance Seven joined, called John Gies Watson.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, Evil John. and with a few other guys, there was eight of us all together. The Whoopee Band went from strength to strength, and Bob, as I said, had good connections. And after that, American Presidents campaign songs. They were great, by the way, you know, Row, Row, Row with Roosevelt.
Oh, no.
Get on your bike with Ike. There was one for Kennedy as well, and I can't remember what it was. Somebody out there will know it. And I don't know what's happened to these programs. I'd love to see them again. I mean, most of the half-hour programs were about the presidents themselves. But
yeah.
There was this campaign song, just to lighten it up a bit, which we played.
Yeah, wonderfully, wonderfully obscure. This is perfect for anybody associated with the Bonzos. You know.
Yes, a bit of research there. I need to find these songs.
Mr. Energy. Only call me Mr. Energy.
before that was Dave Glasson, and in when he was in Tatty Ollity. And Mr. Energy, wasn't he way ahead of his time? That was recorded in 1982. And he was predicting the running out of our resources. And in fact, that was a live performance on British TV. And in fact, it was the second day of broadcasting of TSW in 1982. And it was he was in the Cut Price comedy show on Channel 4. And it has never been on since. Yeah, well, let's get back to the interview. Dave talks about, yeah, he toured, I think, with Dylan and Harvey Goldsmith, a Bill Graham-like impresario in England, and something called choreology. Very interesting. Here's Dave Glasson on Cows Radio.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So Bob had some very good connections, and one was Harvey Goldsmith in his early days, and you know, Harvey put on eventually all the huge names, including Live Aid. Harvey brought Bob Dylan over. Bob Dylan was doing what became known in the early 70s as I think it became known as his Alimony Tour. And he played a week at Baddad at Earl's Court in London here. And we did the support, and we think he watched us, but we probably weren't quite what he... We did some great things, and through his other connections, we played at Roger Daltrey's wedding.
Oh.
Out in a field in Reading, well, a farm, so I say. That was wonderful. That was an experience in itself, because we trundled along there, and we played on the back of a hay wagon, all outdoors. Yeah, audience sitting around on bales of hay, and we did our set, and then other people joined in. You know, quite a few of the other bonzos there as well, and of course all the Who were there. So amazingly, jumping up on stage to play drums with Keith Moon, and
oh wow,
and then bumping into Keith Moon. My wife and I were just having a stroll around the area, and Keith Moon came around the corner dressed as a waiter, talking terribly gentlemanly. You know, it's one of the things that he does. He talks very properly like that sometimes. And more or less interviewed my wife and I as we were standing there for about 10 minutes, and we couldn't say, well, God, you know, Keith Moon spoke to us for 10 minutes. I can't remember a word he said. He was obviously on something else.
Oh, yes.
Certainly not the planet we were on.
Right.
great experiences that we've had. I worked for an hour a week playing piano at a stage school, because in the end, the band gigs weren't enough to sustain rent and everything else that you need. So I started looking around for a flexible day job that involved music. I've been very lucky. I think everything I've done has involved music in one way or another. Started playing piano at quite a well-known stage school. It happened to be Italia Conti. And eventually gradually built that up and was playing for all styles of dance classes, and all types of visiting dance teachers would come in. Some were permanent, but sometimes, you know, they were resting, in inverted commas, and come and do a bit of dance teaching, and I would be able to play for them. So that was a thrill.
Yeah.
And then gradually that job built up. I think the music teacher went away for a while, so I took over the teaching of the music as well. But the kids, they're all school age, mostly have to have regular academic lessons in the afternoon. And they have the sort of their drama, dance, music training in the morning. So I was doing the music, and the older ones were doing O-levels and that sort of thing as well.
Right.
So that was good. And my diploma when I left Trinity College was a teaching diploma. It was the last thing I really wanted to do, because the little bit of experience they'd given us, with not much training at all, was awful, just terrifyingly awful.
Okay.
And all this is, I don't know how people do this, I just can't do it.
Yeah.
Sent us along to a junior school, two of us at a time. And the head teacher would say, well, you know, you'll take this class at this point in the day. And these are the facilities we've got. And by the way, in this cupboard, it's full of percussion instruments, but it's locked and nobody's ever used them. we thought, oh, yes, we'll do that. We'll give each child a percussion instrument, and we'll have some fun with that. Yeah. What a mistake that was. Dear me. And, you know, that lock went back on and then never came out again. We had lived in London for a while, and then once Charlotte was born in the early 70s, we moved to Brighton. I taught at a place that's now long since gone called the Institute of Choreology.
Ooh.
And you have to say now, what is choreology?
What is choreology?
Well prompted. Well, we know what choreography is.
Yeah.
Choreology is the notation of dance. And there's two main systems. There's the Laban system, L-A-B-A-N, a European system, and then there's a British system called the Benesh system, B-E-N-E-S-H. And this Institute of Choreology was run by Mr. and Mrs. Benesh.
Oh.
And it's the notation of dance. It's very clever, really, very impressive, whereas Laban is based on sort of blocks written down on paper. It's the notation, so it's written down dance. So if you think about it, you know, dances could only be passed on before there were videos and cameras and all that sort of thing. Passing a dance on, say a Tchaikovsky ballet, could only be passed on by word of mouth and eyesight, really. You know, a dancer who had been in it would then train the next team and that sort of thing. And it would be passed on through generations when there were no such things as cameras. So this idea of notating it down was invented. And it was a very neat, simple system, really. I mean, it was more complex than I'd like to explain it. But basically, you take the five lines of the music stave. The top line is your head. The next line down is your shoulder. The middle line is your waist. The fourth line down is your knees, and the bottom line is your feet on the floor. And there were various signs as to what position they were in relation to the body based on where you wrote it on these lines. A lot more complicated than that. But their idea was that they would print out, eventually, a piano reduction of a Tchaikovsky ballet score. And on the stave below, they would have the dance notation at the point, you know, in the music, mm-hmm. where those particular steps happened right the way through. I mean, you know, ballets wow. can be 40 minutes to an hour to even longer. So these were big scores. And yeah. a lot of the choreologists, the students, they were all mature students. They were all ex-dancers, really, whose dancing career had really come to an end. But they were all wanted to stay in dance. So they trained to be choreologists. But many of them couldn't read music. So my task was to train them to read the basics of notation so they could follow not only, and they were learning the dance notation as well. So it was a double whammy for that. Well, an enjoyable 3 years, but then the Arts Council, which was funding it, pulled the plug. So it closed down, and then I had to go and get a proper job. Proper job, as in teaching proper job, in a secondary school. I didn't really want to do younger kids because I wanted to do orchestras and big bands and things if I was going to do anything.
Right.
You know, I wanted to have a good time myself. Secondary was the obvious age. I hadn't thought of going higher. Maybe I should have done. But I had, in the end, the school that I taught at, which is in Hove, which is, you know, it's like Brighton and Hove is the same city, really,
right.
Called Blatchington Mill. Was wonderful, really. It was great. It was, you know, we were putting orchestras together and big bands, and from nothing, because the school was new, and we went from strength to strength very quickly. Got a really good reputation. In the end, we were doing exchanges with Germany. Every other year, we were taking a big band over to Germany. And we actually brought the big band to Rhode Island twice and did an exchange program there. So that was great, bringing Coles back to Newcastle.
Yeah.
So with the band, I decided it was going to be an education for the kids, but also fun. You know, they could learn some music that they might not otherwise come across. So we played quite a bit of jazz right across the gamut of Duke Ellington, Glenn Miller, Herbie Hancock, all those sort of things. You know, just had a go at everything, really.
Well, yeah, very ambitious for
Weather Report, I remember doing Birdland. and also pop stuff as well. So eventually we were going out playing gigs, and this school band getting professional bookings at all the hotels. You know, Brighton is full of hotels, being a seaside town, and it's used for conferences. And we were booked. We could have done quite a lot of work. We had to be careful. We didn't overwork the kids because they were sort of late-ish night bookings on a Saturday night.
Who kept the dogs in?
The dogs, they were a-playing at a venue in the town.
We saw it in the papers and thought we'd come right down.
Then they started looking for a place to stay. The sign outside said Doris Jones, and the bands all said, hey, hey!
Greensboro Social Club, we've got a lovely landlady this week, Doris. Doris Karloff.
Hello!
Feed the dogs to Mrs. Jones. Feed the dogs to Mrs. Jones.
People say they're all pretty good.
They're bringing down the neighborhood.
Feed the dogs to Mrs. Jones.
They thought they'd better practice, so Neil wrote out some dogs. When Mr. Slater saw them, he said,
there's lots and lots.
But Roddy had a curry and felt he would explode. He used those dots to wipe the spots from the middle of the road.
Keep the dogs in Mrs. Jones. Keep the dogs in Mrs. Jones.
People say they're all pretty good,
but they're bringing down the neighborhood.
Keep the dogs in Mrs. Jones.
The nightclub as the time wore on and on. Spread got tired of waiting and burst right through the throng. The crowd all looked at the other guys to see just what was wrong. But Auntie Betty cried out loud,
he's got no trousers on!
Keep the dogs in Mrs. Jones! Keep the dogs in Mrs. Jones!
People say they're all being good,
but they're bringing down the neighborhood!
Keep the dogs in Mrs. Jones!
Doris had a daughter. Her name was Betty Jean. When Viv and Larry saw her,
their hormones began to cream.
But later on the carpet, Larry met his Waterloo. When she stepped inside, Doris cried,
here, I want a word with you.
Keep the dogs in Mrs. Jones. Keep the dogs in Mrs. Jones.
People say they're awfully good,
but they're bringing down the neighborhood.
Keep the dogs in Mrs. Jones.
Keep the dogs in, Mrs. Jones, and that's by the Three Bonzos and a piano, which Dave Glasson, my interview guest, belongs to. I've been playing selections from Three Bonzos and a Piano, the Hair of a Dog CD, and also from Dave Glasson and Chum's Hernia Years. as I say, be ready for anything. Yeah, let's get back to Dave's interview. We'll listen to a bit about his big band stuff and his forays with Tatiolity and the Slightly Dangerous Brothers. This is Cal's Radio. You listen to from downtown Occidental.
And then I took myself off for a sabbatical year. I think it was about one of the last to ever get a sabbatical year in secondary education. And did a year's course at City University in London on music technology.
Oh, I went to City back in the 60s, yeah.
Really? Ah. What did he cover?
Well, it was mechanical engineering.
Oh, right, yes. Well, it is very much known for that, isn't it?
Yes.
And certainly this music technology was more technology than music. Mm. Was far more, shall we say, it wasn't a practical course at all. We didn't get near a synthesizer at all, but we'd learn how a synthesizer works. Did we learn how analogs converted to digital and all of that? And, you know, just a very complex mathematical course. And I still haven't got my maths O level, so it was tricky for me.
Yeah.
But, you know, in a way, it was nice not to go and do school teaching for a year. And I have enjoyed it, and I've sort of tried to keep the variety going. And I think it was great having played in a band for 10 years before I went into teaching. I mean, I didn't stop playing in bands, but, you know, I could bring that aspect to it, which quite often students go to training college when they've left sixth form to train to be a teacher, and then come straight back in and train and do their teaching practice, and then become teachers, and they haven't really done anything outside of education, really.
Right.
So I felt that was very useful for me. I could bring that experience. I mean, and it was great for me as well, because in the Whoopee band, they weren't really great at playing arrangements. One or two could read quite well, but others couldn't. So arrangements were really quite hard work. You would write down this splendid arrangement, you thought, take it along, take all night to get it some semblance of what you think it should sound like.
Yeah.
You come back the next week and everybody had totally forgotten, not everybody, but most forgotten what they'd done, because they hadn't had, if they'd had music, they hadn't practiced it. If they'd had music, they couldn't read it. So it was really a case of doing it over and over and over again. And the best thing was actually to put it in front of an audience. Then you really had to, you know, pull the stops out and try and remember it as best you could. We're still doing that now.
Yeah. Now, I see, pull the stops out. That's an old organ.
That's it, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. I've been pulling a few stops out of my time. The Whoopee band, I left in 79 when I was given a higher position at the school on the first floor. I couldn't deal with that responsibility, and Whoopee band was busy. I mean, we were doing two regular gigs a week in London, so it was a matter of driving 50 miles there and 50 miles back from Brighton twice a week, plus whatever engagements we're in on Fridays and Saturdays anywhere in the country. So it just got too much, and I gave up the Whoopee band. Overlapping that, we'd started Tatiology, and Tatiology was a four-piece with Roger Spear and Sam Spoons and a guy called Dave Knight, who sadly died 2 or 3 years ago now. Firstly, I'd come across Roger again when he was making his solo albums, obviously well after the Bonzos had broken up. He'd done Unusual, and then I was invited to come in and play on a couple of tracks on, what was that one called? Electric Shock.
Oh, I love that album.
Yeah. Well, I'm on, I think, the first two tracks of that. So that's how I met up with Roger, and of course the new Sanf and Whoopee band, and we said, and Roger had been doing various things with various people, and on his own as well with his giant kinetic orchestral wardrobe.
Right.
I think he'd missed the fun of playing with other people. So we formed Tatiology. Don't ask me where that name comes from. It's sort of rough around the edges, and jollity being a bit of fun. And Tatiology was just a bit too much of a mouthful.
Right.
One of Sam Spoons' great names. He's very good at names. He came up with three bonzos and a piano. We did quite a bit of work. In fact, our main claim to fame is we got a TV first. Channel 4 was just opening in 82, 83, can't remember now. Roger knew this guy who was working for TSW, Television Southwest, and wanted a band to play a number each week in a programme called the Cut Price Comedy Show. Why? We always get lumbered with cut things. Our job was to perform a song, and it had to be an original song because they couldn't afford paying copyright.
Oh dear.
And Roger and I, separately but between us, wrote five songs each, and I did the theme tune as well. Some of which are still popping up here and there on CDs today. On the Three Bonzos one, Flies was one of them that we originally did, and Sea of Love. So we did that, and I did okay. It was the show going out once a week for 10 weeks. Tatiology just really kept on going. We got the odd TV thing. We put out a single on Rough Trade, distribution. The single's called Punctuation. Again, you can find it, listeners, on the new Three Bonzos one. We've put it on specially as an extra. That worked quite well for quite a while. We did a lot in Brighton. Every summer we played on the beach for every Sunday afternoon for 6 weeks of the school summer holidays. Mm. Roger would come down from London, all the dreadful traffic, and go back in again in it. I don't know how he did it. And we performed lots of old rubbish out there on the seafront, never knowing in the morning if it was going to rain or be windy or whether anybody's going to sit out there in deck chairs. But yeah. Somehow we managed to do most of them. And the rest of the band there was made up of various people. Drummer student from school played drums, Sam First, whose uncle was Frankie Vaughan.
Oh, I know Frankie Abels.
Yeah. My daughter Charlotte played guitar. On it. Need another saxophone. We had Roger. And a guy called Doug Henning played bass. I know we did another TV Southwest, a one-off called Mr. and Mrs. Roger put together a Hunting Tigers medley, we called it, which was Hunting Tigers, Let's Twist Again. So he could dance with the doll. Fernando's Hideaway. And we pre-recorded it in a studio in London and then mimed to it on the TV. There's all our secrets coming out now. And in that particular band, it did go through a few metamorphoses. Was Chris Welch on drums. Chris Welch, the well-known melody maker journalist, and written a book on Viv as well. And that particular performance, you can see that on our website. I think it's on our website, threebonzosandapiano.co.uk.
Okay.
And the audio part of it is on my own solo CD, Hernia Years. No, well, it's got all the stuff. I've pulled off various formats from cassette tape to videotape to anything and put onto a CD. Took me a while. It's called Hernia Years because I had a hernia operation in 2003, I think. And I was laid up for 4 weeks, couldn't go to work, so I did all this. It was great fun, actually, putting stuff together. So the stuff from the Whoopi Band days, so the one track I wrote on a Whoopi Band album, Victorian Albert Museum, with Vernon on vocals, and we've revised that recently because Vernon's been guesting for us occasionally, and we've done Victorian Albert Museum again. Real pleasure.
Lovely.
He said, I'll come and guest if I can do Victorian Albert Museum. Other stuff that's on this album is stuff I've done with Roger with the follow-on from Tatchology was the Slightly Dangerous Brothers, which was just basically Roger and myself. And we recorded a song called Let's Talk Basic in Roger's basement studio and made a video, which is also on our website. You can see that. It's not on our website. It's on YouTube. If you type in Let's Talk Basic or Slightly Dangerous Brothers or Tatiology, I think you'll find it. Wonderful video. Great video. Well ahead of his time was Roger, but we never did anything with it. Mm. As I say in the CD, it was recorded in his basement and stayed in the basement. And then there's a few tracks from the Cut Price Comedy Show series that I wrote.
Oh, yeah.
Two or three tracks with the Glass and Trio. That's my son on drums and Charlotte on saxophone.
Oh, good.
And then one or two tracks from the school big band stuff that I've written because of copyright things. A project called Noah's Flood. And it's a varied track, listeners, a very varied CD of 19 tracks, and I think you'd need to own one, really.
It seems like it. Yeah, everybody should
absolutely
have one.
Yeah. Yeah. Self-promotion, why not? Nobody has one.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's talk Basic by the Slightly Dangerous Brothers. And they are not brothers, they are not dangerous, but they are slightly. And that's Dave Glasson, Dave Knight, and Roger Ruskin Spear from 1985. So again, very prescient with computer stuff. How it would affect our lives. 1985. I think I got my first computer then, 20 megabytes or something. I think wristwatches have more than that now. Let's go back to my interview with Dave Glasson.
From the daily grind of teaching to going out and working in the evenings with these great guys. Most of them were just very, very interesting guys. Gave me a side of life that I wouldn't have ever seen if I just remained or just stayed as a teacher. It was really eye-opening. I do remember the day I first ever met Vernon Dudley Bohe-Knoll. Bob Kerr had a shop in Putney in southwest London. Very near to the Half Moon, where we played every Wednesday I played for 11 years there. The day that Vernon was coming along to consider joining the band, he turned up in a red, white, and blue check, dogtooth check suit. Big hat, big flowery shirt, and big tie. You know, it was the days of psychedelia in those days. He just had so many stories to tell. And of course, having known him from Gorilla, just audio-wise, and I think I'd seen the Bonzos once live, although he'd left by then, I was just very impressed by that. And remain very good friends, and of course he was in the Whoopee band all the time I was in it. It's really nice now to be working with him again, even if it's only occasionally. And he's amazing. I knew at the time he was quite a bit older than me, but really it gets quite significant as you get this much older. Sam, of course, you're asking about relationships. I'm really delighted to be playing again with Sam, because whenever we went on tour and we had a bit of spare time, you know, I'd always find myself hanging out with Sam, really. And the others, of course, as well. But, you know, like an eight-piece band, you can't go around as eight of you at a time.
Right.
And Sam awakened my interest in collecting things. And now I've got metal signed, enamel signs screwed on my house wall all over the place, and odd sorts of things that I probably would never have ever thought of looking twice if I'd not worked with these crazy bunch of guys. You know, they all had their very specialist interests, and it was a real eye-opener for me. Slightly Dangerous Brothers with Roger had fizzled out in the 90s, and then I'd heard we'd sent Christmas cards to each other, and I don't think we'd really ever spoken much then again on the phone or anything. I'd heard that Roger had got tinnitus and couldn't play anymore. And it was so sad, really, because although I'd never thought at the time that we would ever play again, it seemed a shame. And I knew that Sam had kept going, because a whole group of them, about 2 years after I left the Whoopee band, virtually all the rest of the band left the Whoopee band, and Bob had to sort of reform it with new guys. And then most of the guys who left formed a band called Bill Poster's Wilby Band.
Oh, yeah.
And they do quite a few gigs, but they have a regular monthly slot at the Bull's Head in Barnes, very close to the Half Moon. And they've been doing that. They celebrated their 25th anniversary a year or so ago. And on about that time, well, it was 2008, summer. Well, going back a couple of years before that, so you were talking about the Bonzos, suddenly were there again in the public eye, weren't they?
Yeah.
It was such a surprise, because I wasn't, you know, you'd think I would have heard it on the grapevine knowing the guys, but we hadn't really been in touch. And the first I knew about it was seeing an advert in the paper that they were going to do a show at the Astoria in London. So I rang Sam and tried to find out. And then he said, well, they're looking for people to do the intro and the outro, to represent all the different people in the intro and the outro. Will you be one? Yeah, we can get you in then. So, so that'd be good. And we'll get two tickets for, you know, the rest of the family who can come up. Charlotte and Chris, as it happened, my wife.
Yeah.
They got in fine with their tickets. I had to go around the back. Was I going to be let in? No, I had no proof I was. I couldn't get in. in the end, I thank God for mobile phones. I was able to find a number of somebody who I knew was inside the theatre who would come in and vouch for me. John Gies Watson came in and said, "Yes, he is Dave Glasson. Yes, he is. He will be doing a guest spot." got me in, so I nearly missed the show. And in the end, I didn't do anything on the intro and the outro because I'd missed any chance of rehearsal.
Oh, no.
But it was a chaotic show, but a brilliant, brilliant show, really. Neil had got his band there because he was a bit concerned that, understandably, that maybe musically it would be a little bit rough around the edges. So he got his band that he was touring with at the time to do the sort of musical support. And then, of course, as you've probably heard from other guys, they got a few of the stars of British stage and TV, Aid Edmondson and Stephen Fry. To do the Viv bits, Paul Merton, Phil Jupiters, guys are irregular on our screens, who were all being worshippers of the Bonzos and Viv from as long as they can remember. So that was wonderful to see them, and I mean, the houses were packed. They did a tour, did their 15-day tour.
Right.
A few months later, did the album, Pour les Amours des Chiens, and during that time, 2008, Sam's band, Bill Posters, their pianist was not going to be there for one of the months. I think it was July. And said, would I come and dep? I'd depped once or twice before. So I was quite keen to do that because I'd left the teaching job. I decided to retire from that in 2004. So I thought it'd be nice to get back into music, you know, missed it in a way.
Yeah.
It was good. So I did this deputy. I really enjoyed it, working back with the guys who are all Whoopie Bang guys virtually. I had a lot of fun and thought this would be nice to do again. And isn't it good Roger's playing? What a shame he's in the Bonzos. I thought selfishly. Within weeks of playing for Sam's band in July, got news that they weren't going to continue because Neil had pulled out and they couldn't really go as the Bonzos. And they were sort of at a loose end, what to do. I think Bob had some ideas of what he'd suggested a few things that could be done, but they didn't want to go along that line. So I thought, well, there's an opportunity. I rang Sam. I said, this Bonzos thing doesn't look like it's going to continue. Do you want to do something? I know you've got your own band as well. He said, oh, yeah. Sam's always very keen to do any playing, which is great. And I said, okay, I'll ask Roger, now that I know he's playing again. I phoned Roger up, and Roger, well, I don't know, this Bonzo thing, it's not decided exactly what's going to happen. So I said, well, I'll book a venue in Brighton, let's try something out. You know, it's basically reviving Tatiolity. Dave Knight, our lead singer, had a lovely voice, had died, so we were wondering who to replace him with, and Roger came up with the idea of Rodney Slater, who was also very keen to play, but wasn't a singer, and was in fact another saxophone player.
Okay.
Well, that's an interesting four-piece, you know, two saxes and four guys who can't sing. Songs across. I booked this venue in Brighton, just a small one, you know, barely a 100-seater, like a little club, really. I booked three consecutive months in late October. So Roger said, okay, we'll see how it goes, see what the interest is. Well, it was sold out.
Wow.
We were amazed. And people were sort of queuing to get in and couldn't get in and had to come back the following month and that sort of thing. And they were coming from all over the country. So there was obviously a need for it. You know, they'd had the taste with the Bonzos reunion and on all the extra guys that were put into the melting pot for that.
Right.
So we did four shows there, four consecutive months, and then we realised we could probably attract a bigger audience than 80 to 100.
Gone. Oh, where's my memory gone? When I woke up this morning, I swear I put it on. Did I leave it in the wardrobe? Is it hanging on the chair? Is it with my keys and bus pass? Christ, I've looked everywhere. Why do I do amnesia? Oh, Lord, I got the blues. Please help me find my feet.
Try looking in your shoes. Oh, silly old bugger, silly old bugger.
I used to be like Jumbo or Leslie Welch, remember him? The distant past shines brilliant, the recent somewhat dim. You'll often find me staring, staring into space, confident that I've arrived. But why am I in this place? Good golly, Miss Molly, how did it come to this? Someday you'll all be old and stupid too, so don't you take the piss. Oi! Those senior moments to forget. When I woke up this morning, I swear I put it on. Did I leave it in the wardrobe? Is it hanging on the chair? Is it with my keys and bus pass? Christ, I've looked everywhere. No, I've not got religion, and I've not been on the scotch. This is just my way of making sure I got my spectacles, testicles, wallet and watch. Oi! Those senior moments to forget.
Keep taking the tablets. Yeah, three bonzos and a piano. And those senior moments by Rodney Slater.
At that time, a guy called Andy Roberts, who also lived in Brighton, came along and offered to sit in for second half. Andy's a famous guitar player with Liverpool Scene, Grimms, and was also brought in to do the Let's Make Up and Be Friendly album, wasn't he? The last contractual obligation album.
That's right.
The session guy on that. So then he knew all the guys anyway, and so we were happy to have him in because he provided a different sound, and because we were all looning about so much, sometimes the music would just fall apart. So it was good to have somebody keeping it going, you know. And it meant we could do things like Canyons of Your Mind with the guitar solo, some other things. And, you know, Nye, because Andy's versatile, he'd play the ukulele and the banjo as well.
Right.
So when three bonzos go, now we go right across the gamut of bonzo repertoire from the early jazz stuff to the late rock and roll stuff. So we can do a sort of fairly authentic versions of those songs, even though there are only five of us now in three bonzos and a piano. Andy is a sort of permanent guest in the band. And then occasional permanent ones, as I mentioned, are Vernon and the late Larry Smith, who comes in now and then and does things. We've got so many gigs in this 2011 year already. It's looking very promising. Last year we did the Glastonbury Festival, which is right. Always a useful one to do, because it sort of gives you a little bit of kudos to get more festivals and more bookings, and I think it certainly worked. Away, you know, it brings you to the eyes of people who may not otherwise be aware that you're out there.
Right.
And of course, we launched our CD nearly a year ago, February last year. Bloomsbury Theatre, that Central London, that sold out, 500 seater, that sold out. So that's gone very well, and you know, so the CD sales are selling, tripling out, but selling well, selling steadily, and nearly every month there seems to be a review in some magazine or other, even though it's been out all this time.
Oh.
I think there's going to be a review of it in Mojo magazine. I don't know if you get that over in the States. And contrary to an article in the Classic Rock magazine this month, I don't know, do you get Classic Rock over there? We got an article, an interview with Roger on page 108. Contrary to what he says, we didn't record this CD in my bedroom. Beggar the thought. it was an upstairs room, but it was an office come studio.
Okay.
But I can see that bedroom sounds fun. We took a while. We didn't take that long recording, I suppose. We started in August. Rodney's the one who's become quite prolific. In the days of the bonzos, he wrote not a thing. Well, you can look at all the CDs. He didn't write any of it.
Right.
And freely admits to it. But no, you can't stop him. Well, having done this CD within 2 months, he was saying, well, when are we doing the next one? It's quite a commitment. And so we started, it came out last year, 2010. We started 6 months before that, about 5 months in August, Roddy and I put down backing tracks. I've got quite a sophisticated software set up, but the studio itself is pretty basic. It's not really big enough to get us all in. But in the way things go these days, you rarely get the whole band in all the time for every song anyway. And it was easier to put down tracks myself, backing tracks, guide tracks, as it were. And then the guys who'd written the songs were singing them would come along and sing them. In advance, they'd have to send me the chords. And I do know with Roger, who's just a little bit more familiar with technology and computers and emails and that, that I would send him the backing track of the chords that he'd sent, and he'd write back saying, not fast enough, or can you do an extra chorus on there, can you change the key, do that, send it back, tweak it a bit more, take a few of the notes out, and that sort of thing. And then the backing track would then be sort of agreed, and then at a moment when Roger could manage it, for instance, he would come down from London to Brighton and put down his sax tracks and his vocals and things. We all did our bits of recording. Rodney, pretty organised, knew exactly what he wanted. Roger knew exactly what he wanted, but not able to spend much time doing it. And Sam, Sam had the ideas, but could not write anything down, so it was a case of putting stuff together on the day. And we did pretty well on things like the Prune song, which was not written by him, but we were able to get it off the internet and sort of tear down the chords and that sort of thing. And then he has a great bit where he does Bin It, which is a spoken thing.
Oh, I love that. I love that one.
Recycling, yeah.
Yeah.
And then I got him to do the vocal on Flies, which is the song, one of the songs for the Cut Price comedy show back in the 80s, because I thought he would suit it very well, because the songs that he does are very, shall we say, farmer-orientated. Or have that sort of slant anyway, and he does it great. They're really good. In fact, Flies was the first track ever to be played, we think, on British radio.
Oh.
They played on Radio 2 the week before its release. Yeah, so that was a first for that. You know, we just talked to Rodney last week that he's very keen. He's got a few songs. I think he said he's got 5 songs already. Mm. I've got a similar number. They're not all down on tape, you know, they're just still on paper. And we'll just get on with it, and then hopefully Roger will come up with the goods, and Sam come in and play at least on the tracks that that are already down.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be able to put something out towards the end of this year.
Oh, great.
That's not a promise, but we'll do our best.
I'm going to be holding you to it, even though it's not.
Yeah, well...
Is there a possibility there could be a second generation Bonzos?
Why not? Indeed, I know there are bands out there doing Bonzo stuff, but you actually mean our own offspring being a second Bonzos, do you?
Yeah.
It's possible. Well, who knows? You know, there's enough musicians out there amongst us all to form a semblance of a band. When we did the Bloomsbury show, about 5 of family members marched in with us. We always march in. Our shows, there's marching in from the back. And we augmented the band that day with Charlotte on sax, my son Sam on drums, Roger's son Justin, one of his sons on another drum, I think, Vernon's son Toby on trumpet, and it was a big sound. So why not? Why not? Yeah, and I know that, funny enough, Charlotte has played gigs with Toby Noel. Not realising straight away that, you know, son of Vernon, who Dad used to play with.
Do you want to let everyone know the websites and things where they can get...
Yes, certainly, if listeners would like to. I'm shipping stuff off to the USA nearly every other day. The best way to order it is on our website, which is all one word, 3bonzosandapiano.co.uk. I get involved with the postage and the finances and the admin generally. But I'm enjoying it. It's great fun. I wouldn't want it any other way.
Yeah.
And it's getting us on the road and keeping us on the road and keeping us in front of the keen listener.
Well, all I can say is keep doing it. We love it. Fabulous work. And it's been great to speak to you.
Good. Well, great to speak to you too, Arnold. Good night to all your listeners, or good afternoon, or wherever it is over there when it goes out.
Thank you so much, David Glasson.
Thank you, Arnold.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.